This is the Grinnellian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grinnellian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Grinnellian Bunker, it's your weekly one-stop shop for the weird, the unusual, the unexplained. And that's right. When you're here, you know exactly where you are, where you belong. It is the Grinnellian Report. I'm your happy host, Mr. Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, along with co-host and producer extraordinaire, Mr. Tyler Pittman. How are you, Tyler?
Great. How are you?
Magnificent. I am looking across the Mohorovic discontinuity tonight. There's a strange luminescent air about it this evening. And I see wonderful things, in the words of Howard Carter, the great Egyptologist who stared first into Tutankhamun's tomb, the first man to look into that, to peer into that hallowed opening in the Valley of the Kings in 3,000 years since the burial of the boy king of ancient Egypt. Welcome to the program, my friends. It's so great to have you all here, and I'm glad to be your host. Hi to all you fine folks out there in the chat room. I see they're piling in, as they often do. Is that Cam Hale from the... He's famous, isn't he?
I do believe so.
Yeah.
Evening.
Expanded Perspectives. You know, I hear they're going to be doing a live broadcast of their own 1 week from last night. So that's this coming Monday.
You don't
16th.
Say.
Yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I happen to know because you and I are going to be guests on that little outing. And so it's no doubt going to be a fantastic time. I encourage everyone to check out Expanded Perspectives. I think the site's expandedperspectives.com, but no doubt with the help of Google, folks will be able to find it with no problem. Man, there's been a lot going on in the last few days. And, you know, I have to say there's a lot of ancient mystery news, a lot of listener emails we're going to be getting to. We're going to see what's been trending in the realm of Fortiana. But I also wanted to pay a bit of homage to a couple of fine researchers this evening, researchers who, despite their many contributions to the field, fate, as they say, have caught up with them. The British writer Colin Wilson passed away recently in Cornwall just before midnight. It was only, I believe, late last week. He had become a celebrity at age 26 with the publication of his first book, the famous tome known as The Outsider. Do you remember that book by chance, Tyler?
I do.
The Outsider. Yeah, that was an interesting book. And Colin was also a dear friend to a friend of mine, none other than the psychic Robert Cracknell. But, you know, he wrote a lot of books, and he was known for a lot of different things. He was also a science fiction author. He wrote books that included The Space Vampires, Ritual in the Dark, Life Force, a number of different things. We've lost Colin Wilson, but, of course, his legacy lives on. And then also there was another individual who, and this one just was announced late last night. I heard via our Fortean friend, Mr. Lauren Coleman, that Lloyd Pye, best known for his research involving the famous Starchild skull, has also passed away. I met Lloyd for the first time a little more than a year ago in Pennsylvania, and it was pretty shocking for many of us in the esoteric community when we found out that Lloyd had been diagnosed with cancer. Now, Lloyd, of course, touted for a long time a rather controversial piece. Again, it is known as the Starchild skull. It is a strange relic that appears to be either a malformed human skull or, as Lloyd and many others have advocated, possibly some sort of a skull from other, but perhaps even anomalous origins. Many have even tried to say that perhaps it is an extraterrestrial. Now, again, I don't know if we can prove that, or if you endorse those theories, but nonetheless, it is a unique item and a replica that Lloyd brought with him to certain events. I was shown last winter when I met Lloyd and his assistant for the first time. We had a long ride together on a bus and were able to catch up, and it was a wonderful time. He was a gentle individual and just a true gentleman in every respect. Now, as of December 9th, that was just yesterday, apparently, on his Facebook page, his nephew updated it, saying that Lloyd passed away at approximately 6:15 p.m. Central Time, USA. He had been surrounded by his family and died in his mother's arms. The family asks for privacy at this time as they deal with the loss. And indeed, Lloyd will be missed. He was a fantastic individual, and we can hope that he will continue his research in the great beyond. With that, we'll get to a few listener emails. You know, Tyler, a while back, one of our favorite writers, people who write into the program, that is, Billy Clark in the UK. Billy had written and shared this strange story about something that had been going on with his watch. You remember that? Where he'd woken up a couple of times in the middle of the night, and his watch would appear to stop. And there would always be, it would always be a half hour behind. And it was very peculiar, and he had no explanation for it. And he said, I know for a fact that I wasn't just changing this thing around in my sleep. So he doesn't know exactly what could have been going on. But I've been getting an influx of emails from people who've been talking about strange things that their watches do just as well. And so here are a couple of those emails. Jonathan's the first, right? He said, Mike, I was listening to your program from the 26th of November. I was shocked when I heard you read out an email that you had received from one of your other listeners about a wristwatch that lost time when he was sleeping. Well, I've had a different, but nonetheless a very similar experience. Here's what's happened to me. Now, about 2 years ago, I had received a watch from my grandmother on Christmas. I'd never worn a watch before, but I thought, hey, I'll give it a whirl. Why not? So I inserted the batteries, I put the watch on, went to sleep that night, and forgot to take the watch off. Well, I noticed that the watch had appeared to have stopped working, so I went to a shop and I had more batteries installed, and it instantly began working again. Later that night, I went to bed with the watch, and again, when I woke up the next morning, it had appeared to stop working yet again. So I took the watch off, slid it into a drawer, and forgot about it. Well, about 2 weeks later, I took the watch back out and discovered that the watch, strangely, was working again. Now, I figured it was a little strange, but didn't think too much about it and just slipped it back onto my wrist since it was working. The next day, I woke to another stopped watch. So I went on to test this odd phenomenon with several other watches as well to see if the same thing happens. This occurrence continued from there on. Doesn't matter what kind of watch I wear, the watch simply stops and then starts back up again about 3 days after I remove it. If you have any listeners that could provide an answer, please let me know. I would be very interested to know what's happening. Jonathan, you know, I couldn't tell you what causes that. Again, I've mentioned on this program, my mother claims that she's someone who can't wear a watch in similar fashion. Of course, Billy had described this strange phenomenon where his watch would seem to stop working or at very least be off by about 30 minutes and then he would reset it. But it was always 30 minutes that the watch was off by. Very interesting. Well, that wasn't the only email pertaining to this subject that we received. We also got one from Joe who writes, Dear Micah and the Graylian Gang, I'm one of those people who are quote-unquote chronological device impaired. I like that. I'd always believed that it was just a weird family trait as my grandmother can't wear them either. Yes, every watch I've ever owned stops working just like that, usually within just a month. Now, thinking it could be a quality issue, my wife gave me a very nice Fossil Swiss watch. Well, that one lasted 2 weeks. The longest I've been able to wear a watch was a $3 Casio that I picked up on an impulse buy in a section of the grocery store. And that one lasted almost 6 months before it died. Now, I've tried pocket watches too, mechanical and digital thinking that close contact with or that have close contact with my skin and electromagnetic fields or current that I generate perhaps caused failure. But those also stopped working. Also, or all other electronic devices I own work just fine. Now, my phone and its timekeeping device on it also worked perfectly. I've never had a near-death experience or anything like that, and only experimented in a little elder god worship, if you know what I mean. That's good. It is fascinating to learn that there are more people out there like me, so thanks for the great show, and take care from Joe. That's very interesting, isn't it? So I'm very interested to hear if there are other people out there maybe who have had this kind of thing. Reese Cup in the chat room. Now, who in the world could that be? Hey, Mike, how are you, buddy? He says, my Mary can't wear a watch. It stops completely when she puts one on, and now she wears them for looks. Well, they do make for a nice piece of jewelry. I've always thought, personally, that a nice watch is perhaps the finest piece of jewelry that a man can wear. I mean, you know, some people like to wear crucifixes. I have a crucifix, a Crux Anastas that I wear from time to time. But for the most part, yeah, it's going to be a watch. Now, I don't wear out watches. The watches will run just fine when I wear them. The problem is I wear out the wristbands. The watches continue to work for years, but I can't keep a watch for the wristband wearing out. That's the only chronological impairment I seem to suffer from. One from our very own, Mr. Red Pill Junkie, wrote, and I don't think he'd mind me sharing this email. He and I correspond privately quite a bit, but this one I thought would be worth sharing with the listeners just as well. He says, "Dear Vato, I'm listening to an episode of Don Ecker's Dark Matters Radio featuring an old recording of a 1992 debate that he'd had with Philip J. Klass, the noted UFO debunker. He says, did you know that that pendejo accused Frederick Valentich of smuggling drugs? That's the explanation that he gave as to why Valentich, an inexperienced pilot with so few hours of flight time, or rather, what Klass called an inexperienced pilot, this was the reason why he believed that Valentich decided to risk his life flying solo through oceanic waters at night, because he was smuggling drugs. The four life jackets he carried? Well, that's where he was hiding the dope, according to that, well, I'll leave out what Red Pill Junkie writes. Since it's one of your favorite cases, though, I'm sure you'd find it interesting. Later, RPJ. And the reason I wanted to read this here is because, again, there are times in the study of the strange and the unusual that I personally have found, and Tyler, I'm sure you've seen this just as well, it seems that the explanations that are given for the unusual happenings the explanations that are given for the unusual happenings by the Fortians, or the unexplained enthusiasts, are more credible than the lengths to which some debunkers will go to try and disprove these sorts of arguments. You know, Klass was well known for doing this sort of thing. An object that would be seen moving through the sky by multiple witnesses, he would say, was the planet Venus. Obviously a stationary object. Not entirely stationary, but it's going to move very gradually as the Earth turns. And, you know, I'm thinking, I have, in certain circumstances, I've watched stars that appeared to be at a light that was moving when clouds around them were moving. But after a few minutes of observation, it becomes pretty clear that that momentary optical illusion was nothing that would fool a person who is, you know, at least a few hours or more at stargazing. Even if you're an amateur, you begin to familiarize yourself with what's happening in the sky. And sure, I've never seen anything unexplainable, but when I hear of reports where people have, I'm always, you know, a bit put off by skeptical investigations, the likes of what Klass attempted to pull off, which seem to offer a less credible explanation for the phenomenon than the explanations offered by the so-called theorists of the unexplained, the so-called wild claims being put forth by the paranormal enthusiasts. Sometimes we have to simply accept, I think, that there may be phenomena for which we cannot fully account for. And that doesn't mean that it will forever exist outside science or the boundaries of what we can call scientific knowledge. That doesn't mean that we will always have so little information that we arm ourselves with that we will be forever incomplete in our assessment of these phenomena. I think at some point on down the road, if there is a valid UFO phenomenon, we will scientifically understand that, and we will observe it, and we will be able to account for it fully. But in the absence of a complete data set, I don't think that it's right to say that we, well, simply don't have a phenomenon. We can say that science does not acknowledge a phenomenon. I've even heard, again, we've mentioned him many times on the program since this year's Paradigm Symposium, but P.Z. Myers. I've heard P.Z. Myers even say, obviously, there is some phenomenon. Now, he would like for us to believe, of course, that it's more likely military aircraft, which, of course, I've certainly, you know, postulated myself, or as our friend Graham from Grimerica mentioned, or that it's mental illness that people are suffering en masse. But whatever the case may be, yes, you do end up finding from time to time that despite the unusual circumstances involving these cases, there are certain skeptical debunkers that would offer a more ridiculous answer at times than merely accepting, we don't have to say that they're aliens, but maybe there is some variety of unexplained phenomenon, as yet unexplained phenomenon, that we're dealing with. I don't think it's beyond the realm of the possible, considering the plethora of different varieties of scientific experiences that may await us, and that once we are armed with a fuller knowledge of the sciences, that we will be able to account for.
Yeah, just wait until it becomes, drones become such a everyday occurrence that it becomes the de facto convenient explanation. You just saw a drone.
Well, it's already there. I mean, that's already kind of where we are. I mean, I've seen so many articles that say UFO sightings on the rise as our drones are populated more and more by, or rather our skies are populated more and more by drones.
I've yet to see a lot of people use that idea in UFO chat rooms, though. So,
well, I mean, I don't think that UFO enthusiasts are going to be saying that, but I think that the drones are inevitably going to become an easy escape for the skeptically minded. But again, you know, I am also a skeptical UFO researcher. And when I say I'm a skeptical UFO researcher, what that means specifically is that I don't endorse, per se, an extraterrestrial hypothesis. In fact, I think that while there are valid reports of sightings of disc-shaped craft, I don't think you'd mind me mentioning, but there's one gentleman I happen to know of in the chat room tonight who had an encounter with one of those. Mike Reese, I'm calling you out! his was one of the best. In fact, it was a multiple witness sighting. It took place, you know, Mike got a good look at this thing. He's drawn technical drawings of it, remembers very vividly what happened. Obviously, I think that there are people who have seen disc-shaped craft. But I think that by the same token, the majority of objects that were being referred to as saucers back in the old days of the UFO, the first days of the UFO enigma, back when it was so new a phenomenon that scientific intelligence agencies, you know, the Air Force and the like, they did take this subject very seriously, and they did very seriously discuss openly UFO studies and attempts at trying to come to a full technical understanding and a scientific understanding of what this phenomenon, whether it be a natural phenomenon or some variety of Earth-based technology being represented, what this was. And more often than not, the term being used by the media, flying saucer, simply was not what was being seen. People were seeing something, but flying saucer was a general term that the press began to use for all different varieties of reports of unexplained aerial phenomena, which is the very reason, in part, that the U.S. Air Force decided to use a better term that Edward Ruppelt came up with, as he had been overseeing the first incarnation of Project Blue Book, and he chose to use unidentified flying object, because a flying object could be a plane, it could be a drone, it could be a missile, it could be a variety of different things, but an unidentified flying object does not have to be extraterrestrial. I acknowledge that there are unidentified flying objects. However, I've not seen clear confirmation that we are dealing with extraterrestrial phenomenon, which unfortunately is a meme that so many out there have latched onto without really questioning the nature of the phenomenon, I think. Kathy writes, "Hi, Micah. I have a few suggestions for the founding tenets of the world's most secret society." She says, "Tenet 1, share knowledge freely. And also be willing to listen to the ideas shared by others and engage in constructive dialogue, even if one doesn't agree." I think those are good aspects to maintain in all life. Hey, you know, Tyler, if more people practiced that in business, there would be fewer disputes, wouldn't there? If more people in the congregations of parishes would practice this, share knowledge freely, be willing to listen to the ideas shared by others and engage in constructive dialogue, even if one doesn't agree, I think we would all be able to move forward, whether it have to do with spiritual endeavors, business endeavors, political endeavors, economic endeavors. Those are good tenets to live by in general. She says, "I enjoy listening to the Grayling Report and the Middle Theory podcasts. I just subscribed to your work after hearing you speak on Mysterious Universe and the Paranormal podcast over the last few years. I'm a late comer, but I'm enthusiastic." Well, Kathy, either way, please know we're very happy to have you here as part of the fold, what we call the Grayling Gang. Well, we gather together in a couple of locations, but of course, live on the radio every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern, and then, of course, around the globe on the internet via iTunes, and we're also, I should mention, on Stitcher now just as well for all of you podcast enthusiasts out there. Hey, we'll be back right back after this. I am the Mouth of the South. It is the Grayling Report. Stay with us.
mountains of Appalachia. It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
It is indeed a Graylian evening. Welcome back to the program. This is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, along with Tyler Pittman. I caught myself saying something very funny the other night, Tyler. I looked out. I couldn't sleep. And I went to the window. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was a pale moon shining through the clouds. And as I looked out across the landscape, I looked out and I said, my, my, it is a very Graylian evening. And I hadn't even understood fully what I was saying as I said it. Because if I told you, hey, it's a Graylian evening, I mean, you'd probably think I was in La La Land. No, you'd think I was talking about the Graylian Report, right?
Yes.
I had a totally different meaning, though. And here's why. It was really, really strange. There was an old film that I'd been jonesing for a while, and I decided to watch it. And the movie is called Excalibur. Do you remember it?
I do. I remember going past it in the video store.
Many of our early experiences, you and Jacob and I caught up the other night, and that was something that we all, you know, sharing these memories together, we all recalled what it was like going to the movie store in our youth and the kinds of films that we would see. No, not those kinds of films!
Yeah, we didn't watch those kinds.
We saw, I'll tell you what always fascinated and also frightened me were the horror films, you know, monster movies. I'd stay up every Friday night, and I would wait to see what was going to be on American Movie Classics or Joe Bob Briggs.
Yeah, Joe Bob Briggs.
Yeah.
Yeah, our conversation, we talked for about an hour about how the images on the VHS cassettes often provided the scariest fodder for our nightmares.
Yeah, they really did.
And we never even saw the films at that age, yet we knew all about Freddy and Jason.
That's right. You knew who those individuals were. And more importantly, you knew about them, if not from seeing the films yourself, from the other kids who would come to school talking about Freddy and Jason.
Yeah, and you know they didn't see it either.
They just wanted to sound like they had.
Man, Jason's cooler than Freddy. Chucky is the coolest. I was scared of all of them.
Chucky was not cool.
I still have Freddy Krueger nightmares.
Yeah, well, you know, somebody apparently told Jim Harold that they did, too, back in 1968. Yeah, well, but, you know, I looked outside. I just watched the film Excalibur. I'd been thinking about this movie for a long time. And you know, another one of my very favorite programs of all time. You know, I don't own a television, but, you know, I'll frequent YouTube and look for classic sci-fi and old television programs, old documentaries. I love... Well, it's kind of a funny thing because when you're in the news business, you really want the most up to date information. And yet when you have an affinity for nostalgia, you're getting yesteryear's news. And, but one of my favorite programs, two of them actually, first was In Search Of, narrated by Leonard Nimoy of Star Trek fame. But then there was also, Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World. I like that one, too, and that one being a little newer has a little bit more of a polished production value to it. I think what I loved about In Search Of was the fact that In Search Of just, you know, I mean, the film stock was so grainy, the music was just archaically simple with the little synthesizers and things, you know. But
I love that.
I love it. It had such atmosphere. There'll just never be another program that had both the compelling content that program offered and also that had that kind of, you know, just before we were really legit feel to it, if you know what I mean. By around the early 80s, television video production and the like really began to change. And by the time Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious Universe was popular, that program had some of those same aspects that In Search Of had, but it just didn't seem to have that same appeal. I don't know. But what I liked about Arthur C. Clarke's approach, though, was that he would tackle world mysteries, and yet he also, you could tell, he was a skeptic. And he certainly would be accommodating for the discussion of these sorts of things, but if something seemed pure bunk, he would tell you. He definitely was more willing to come out and express his skepticism and a scientific background as he dealt with these sorts of subjects. So I found both programs really interesting. I always enjoyed them. And I had been reviewing I guess it was actually the In Search Of episode that was In Search Of the Holy Grail. But it, of course, got into Arthurian legends a good bit. And so that reminded me of the film, and I thought, you know, I need to finally obtain Excalibur and watch that. So I did. I obtained a copy of Excalibur, and I sat down, made time in my busy schedule, and I disciplined myself and made myself work. I think I finally took myself off the clock at around probably 1:30 or 2 a.m., and I'm not an incredible night owl these days, but literally, I mean, that was the only time I could allot for it. So I started really late, and it's a long film. But by the time I was done with the film, I have to say, you know, it's a bleak film in a way. The Arthurian legends are absolutely captivating, and I ended up talking with Scotty Roberts about this a little the next day. But there are these aspects to the Arthurian legends that are both beautiful, that are absolutely sad, that are haunting, and not haunting necessarily in terms of, you know, the romantic aspects, you know, the love triangle between Arthur and his lady love Guinevere, but she, of course, you know, held an affinity for the chief knight of the Round Table and of Arthur's court, Sir Lancelot. You know, it was a very interesting story between them, and of course, in the film, it was... for the time, I guess, pretty explicit the way that it was presented in Excalibur, but there were elements of that film that were very interesting to me. One, for instance, despite the film being the story of Arthur, the story kind of circles around Merlin, you know, off and on. Merlin, however, despite his apparent omnipotence as a wizard, you know, he's even alluded to in that film as not necessarily being, you know, among the normal, you know, man, the ranks of the normal human. But Merlin, despite his omnipotence and his magical abilities, you know, he kind of has this, I don't know, there's almost like a humorous kind of a thing going on there, too. There's kind of a court jester-esque kind of a trickster element to him. And it's just very interesting, the portrayal of, it's almost kind of a dichotomy, a very, very, very human individual, but at the same time, also a all-powerful, inhuman wizard. You know, I mean, it's kind of strange. Now, I'm sure people are probably thinking, okay, well, what? Great, is this Micah Hanks Does Movie Reviews? But think about this. I'd been interviewing Philip Coppens a while back, and he said at one point during the interview, it was something that was just really beautiful. I may even have the soundbite here someplace. I'd have to look for it, though. But when I spoke with Philip, he had said something to the effect of, and actually, funny enough, some of the listeners out there may remember this better than I do, something to the effect of the importance of a world where we can have a word that combines grail and alien. Now, in the earliest days of the Grailian Report, you know, I think as a researcher, I was more open to the possibility of an extraterrestrial hypothesis with UFOs. And gray alien is actually the origin of the term Grailian. But I always remember what Philip said. And, of course, Philip, with his research into megalithic sites and European folklore and whatnot, he was, of course, very well versed in the search for the Holy Grail and the Arthurian legends and the like. And as I look out after watching that film, I couldn't sleep. And I'm looking out across the landscape, and I said out loud, "My, it is a Grailian night," fully unaware of the fact that I was saying, you know, the name of this enterprise that I've been behind for going on 7 years now. And it took on an all new meaning, despite Philip Coppens having said it, despite, you know, having already drawn that parallel myself. The Grail. But what is the Grail? You know, when we say in our culture, Holy Grail is meant to denote what? I mean, Tyler, if I asked you, Holy Grail, what comes to mind when I state that? What does the Holy Grail mean to you?
I guess the image that I have is of either the cup or some type of cabinet.
Cabinet?
Yeah.
Now, why does a cabinet come to mind?
Well, why would a cup come to mind?
I mean the historical interpretation of the Grail is of the chalice that was used at the Last Supper of Jesus Christ.
Right.
But it is interesting because I think that Holy Grail has come to mean a lot of different things. I mean, think about it in our culture today. If I said, you know, Lauren Coleman is the Holy Grail among cryptozoological researchers, which many hold that he is, you know, or you could say, you know, a Les Paul is a Holy Grail among electric guitars, which is why Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, who happens to be quite the UFO enthusiast, as our buddy at the Huffington Post, Lee Spiegel, has told me. You know, I mean, you could say that, hey, yeah, that's the Holy Grail of guitars. He named his guitar the Holy Grail, or Pearly Gates, rather, I think. I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, Billy Gibbons necklace.
Well, no, Pearly Gates. Pearly Gates was the name of the guitar, but he called it the Holy Grail. You know, and as a matter of fact, I've even referred to my, I play Les Paul as well, and I've referred to it as the Holy Grail. You know, the Grail imagery, Grail has come to mean in our society, essentially the epitome of the greatest of the great, the finest, the most holy, the most reverent. And there is a lot of, while we discuss, for instance, the Holy Grail that we have seen maybe in the Indiana Jones films, as Nikki in the chat room there points out, you know, the third film actually being the quest for the Holy Grail, revisioned in the context of the Indiana Jones films. You know, we append to it the idea of the actual chalice used at the Last Supper, but the Grail has been understood to possibly be other things historically just as well. There are pagan rituals that it is drawn all the way back to. And, you know, we talk about, what's the site? Glastonbury Tor there in England. I would love to go there, but there is basically a maze that winds its way up to the citadel at the top of the hill, and nearby at the base of a cliff down by the water's edge, a little drawing was found that shows essentially a little path, a little maze, a labyrinth, if you will. And the path that is etched into the side of the mountain that leads to the top of Glastonbury Tor actually takes you. It's funny because I was talking with Scotty Roberts about this, and he said that he'd gone there back in the 1990s. And when he visited the site, he said that his friend, his guide, had referred to it as a Wiccan ghetto or something like that.
Is there such a thing?
I don't know. I mean, you know, this is a funny term, but I mean, the idea is, I mean, that, you know, modern spiritualists, practitioners of earth religions, Wicca, druids, you know, descend upon that site, and they view it as something, you know, it's a sacred site.
Right.
It's a sacred place.
A site of ancient Wiccan druid ritual.
Yes. So, it's, of course, and it's just, you know, a beautiful place, I have to say.
Yeah, I think Wicca is just like the modern day reincarnation of druidic principles.
Here in the West, actually, Ray Buckland had been the chief proponent of what is known as Gardnerian Wicca. I met Ray Buckland once as well, you know, wonderful little guy. But, you know, it's funny because I think that the reason for the adherence to and the maintenance of these traditions, you know, the Arthurian legends, and I've got right here, in fact, I should mention this, here on my desk, two books. I've got Jerome Clark's Encyclopedia of the Unexplained, fantastic book, everybody should have that. But then I've also got T.H. White's The Once and Future King. There have been so many books over the years. And I have to say that, I always say this, in fact, that my father is the person who is directly responsible for, you know, getting me into so much of this. My father, he is still an active Episcopal priest and a member of the clergy of the Diocese of Western North Carolina. Now, I was raised, you know, in a Christian household, and as well as those values that I've maintained, I also do adhere to, you know, I've talked about cosmic love and kind of universal spiritualism, what I call it, which doesn't mean just, you know, believe everything and anything that you want. It really kind of is an adherence to and an understanding of esoteric principles, traditions, and mythologies from around the world, because as you begin to dig into those things, something I have told a lot of people who are adherents of and who, you know, will champion Christian tradition, you do find that certain religions and other mystical practices, philosophies, you know, and perennial traditions from around the world, you will begin to find that there are parallels to them. And to me, what that is indicative of is the interconnectedness of myth, symbol, language, culture, and the origins, ultimately the origins of humankind. But all of those things it could be argued, could be symbolized with the presence of the Grail in our mythology. The Holy Grail has come to represent so many of those things. It would be, honestly, it would be, I think, appropriate to say that while the Grail, borrowing Christian iconography and direct references to the chalice used at the Last Supper, that the Grail itself is something that, thanks to the Arthurian legends, is known to be a part of English folklore. The ties that it has to earlier pagan traditions show that there is an ancient, a much older connection that we have to whatever this object is. I don't think that the Grail is so much an object as it is a concept, and that it has embodiments, and that it has had embodiments over time. You know, you could look at certain, again, to borrow from, you know, Judeo-Christian traditions, you could look at certain things such as, for instance, the Ark of the Covenant, you know, maybe even Noah's Ark to an extent. Some have maintained that the Ark actually existed and that this anomaly on top of Mount Ararat that even NASA has photographed may be actual physical evidence of that. Now, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Grail, I'm sure that a chalice and such was used pre-biblical writing, but I think it was first alluded to in the Bible and then that's the central focus. I mean, even think of like the Knights Templar and stuff supposedly hiding it, but also I think the kind of the Celtic tie-in with the Arthurian legends, you know, drawing upon earlier myth and stuff, because that image is absent from Eastern religions, the chalice.
Yeah, well, the interpretation of the Grail as being a cup. You know, again, I think that the cup, it's funny, I had
the communion that you would take, sacrament, it's kind of like a reminder or a symbol of the renewal you get through the blood.
Right. You know, there was a priest a few years ago, Tyler, who told me, the Reverend Hugh Edsel. There's a funny story about this. I told you that I had a Christian upbringing myself. And as a young man, I was told that, you know, of course, he had baptized me. And I was told that, I may have told this story on the air before. If not, this is a first for you Graylians out there. But this is an interesting story. The father that I'm talking about, Father Hugh Edsel, he passed away just earlier this year. And he was a dear man, dear soul. You know, a friend to me for a number of years. And when he and his wife Judy had been living in Florida, after Ted Bundy was sentenced to death, the funeral home that had held his body requested that a priest come and bless the funeral home, because they said that there was a real feeling of just darkness and an icky kind of a, you know, just an unsavory feeling there in the funeral home. And so Father Hugh Edsel was the priest who actually was called and who came out and brought holy water and blessed the funeral home where, at the time, the remains of serial killer Ted Bundy were being kept. Gosh, how creepy is that? The same,
gross.
The same priest baptized me. Very interesting, huh? So, yeah. But But the same priest also told me something very interesting. He had defined a sacrament, you know, especially in Catholicism. You know, we have, you know, the seven holy sacraments, including the sacrament of marriage, sacrament of holy unction, which is laying the hands upon and healing and sometimes making a sign of the cross with oil, blessed oil. There's the rite of exorcism in the Catholic tradition. But, of course, probably the best known of the sacraments, well, I guess the rite of exorcism isn't a sacrament. That's a rite, but the best known of the sacraments is what is in Judeo-Christian tradition called, you know, Holy Communion. But Father Edsel once said, you know, a sacrament is a spiritual handle on a physical reality. Or rather, I'm sorry, it's a physical handle on a spiritual reality. In other words, it's something that's physical that we can apply to, a spiritual concept that evades human understanding, but that helps us to bring it into human terms and understand it. That is how he defined a sacrament. And if you think about it, I think that the image of the Grail, even though T.H. White's, this edition of the book, you know, has the sword in the stone on the front, Excalibur, the famous sword, you know, the film that we were talking about that begun this conversation, it was named for this. Excalibur has kind of become a central focus in this Arthurian legend, but I would think that there's nothing quite as enigmatic as that Grail, but I think that yet it just is, as Father Hugh had told me, with regard to the Grail being representative of, or rather any sacrament being representative of, a spiritual reality that's much deeper, the Grail is an image that seems to represent something deeper in our psyche. Now, the question is, and this is what's so fascinating to me, what? What is the origin of the Grail? And the reason it's so important to me, obviously, is exactly what happened to me the other night. I look outside and I said, it is a Grailian evening. I merely meant that, the countryside illuminated by the moon reminded me of England. And I'm thinking, it's funny because it's all come full circle for me in my mind. And here's this Grailian, this image, the Grail, it's like it smacked me in the face. And all of a sudden, here I felt like Monty Python going on my own search, you know. I mean, it was kind of profound. It really was. Tyler, you think I'm crazy, don't you?
Oh, I was just doing some reading based on this stuff.
You were just okay. Yeah, you were just tuning me out.
Yeah, well, I think the romantic part of it ties back to the Celtic religions, you know, the early stuff. But there's some theorist.
There we go.
Talking about how the Grail could be a combination of the Christian and the Celtic stuff. In replacing of the Shroud of Turin.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll leave it at that. I think we're going to go ahead and take it to a break. It is the Grailian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Welcome back. It is the Grailian Report on our own personal quest for the Holy Grail. And if anyone out there happens to know where a couple of Grailians can find a Grail lying around, well, do tell. info@grailianreport.com. We'd love to hear from you. And speaking of those ancient mysteries, the website Western Digs carried this fascinating story earlier this week. A hunter-gatherer who tracked through a desert oasis 100 centuries ago. Left the continent's most lasting impression, the oldest known human footprints anywhere in North America. Now, there are only two of them, one left and one right, but the ancient traveler's path through mineral-rich sediment in the Chihuahuan Desert allowed them to become enshrined in stone and now dated some 10,500 years later. Boy, in tracing our origins back to the very root of civilization, you know, again, I feel that the Grail image is representative of more of a concept embedded within our collective psyche rather than an actual chalice or cup. But imagine, even earlier than those legends had seen their genesis, 10,500 years ago in the Chihuahuan Desert, there was a man, a hunter-gatherer, standing there looking up at the sky. For all we know, he was wondering about those same mysteries. Maybe he had a simpler viewpoint or a simpler understanding of the world around him, but nonetheless it was a world which he wished to know and to own to an extent. To my knowledge, according to Dr. Nicholas Felstead, a geoarchaeologist at Durham University right here in North Carolina, he said, to my knowledge, the oldest human prints previously reported in North America are around 6,000 years old, so the prints here in the Chihuahuan Desert predate those by some 5,000 years. The tracks were first discovered during highway construction in northeastern Mexico, about 300 kilometers from the Texas border back in 1961. They were excavated and then taken to a local museum for study, but the precise location was lost to history. Now, a search for the site in 2006 came up empty, but it did turn up additional tracks, around 11 of them, in the general area where the original first prints were believed to have been found, a marshy, spring-fed desert refuge known as the Cutaro Cienegas. Now, both sets of prints are ones that have been identified before and are the only reported footprints in the Cuatro Cienegas Basin, but neither have previously been dated, according to Dr. Felstead. He and his team were able to date the tracks because they were preserved in travertine, a sedimentary rock that contains minute traces of uranium and the waters in which it formed. But it's so fascinating because you can look at these and maybe the most striking thing about these footprints is how similar they are to a human foot of today. Now, why, of course, only in geological time, 10,000 years ago, a man would be so different from the man of today. Really, we weren't that much different. I mean, in terms of the way that our minds functioned and, of course, our cultural values, our attitudes, you know, lifestyle, technology, all those things were very different. But essentially, you go back, you know, as much as 2, 3, 4,000 years ago, when you take a person from that long ago. You bring them to the present day, and they would, hypothetically, let's say you took them as a child and brought them up in our environment, in our world, they would conceivably be able to function. You know, a person who had been a child born in ancient Greece, for instance, would be able to function here today in our society in all likelihood with any of the same abilities to grasp and comprehend their surroundings and technological advancements that have occurred since that period as you or I. You know, conceivably, these people would not be any different. But you go back a little further, though. You go back 10,500 years, and I can't help but wonder about what a man like that might have been like. It is indeed truly a mystery, the mystery of our origins. And speaking of those ancient mysteries, another one that's always fascinated me. When I was down Tyler last summer, I went down and I visited the Outer Banks. Have you ever been there?
I have.
The Outer Banks are absolutely, talk about a place that just has a ghostly feel to them. And whether or not you want to endorse the idea of there being an actual ghostly presence there, there's certainly a ghostly feeling. You know, I think the Atlantic Ocean, especially if it's overcast, it's just a very eerie old place. And you go to those old beaches, the old lighthouses. And, you know, my assistant and dear friend, Susan Davidson, and I had gone out there, and she grew up in this area, and so she really wanted badly to take me out and show me this one particular lighthouse. And so we were headed out there, and going out there in the middle of the night, and I've got a great photo of Susan standing next to this lighthouse right as the sun was going down. It's just incredible. But one of the most interesting things that she showed me was she showed me this little tree. Well, it's not really a really small tree, but I mean, it's not like an oak or something or a pine like you'd see growing here in the mountains. It was a tree out on an island, and it had a part of a word inscribed into it. Part of a word. And you could sort of make out what it said. Well, the story about the tree had been, and I've got photos of that too, the story had been that the people there on the island remembered those words being carved in the bark of that tree for as long as anyone had lived there on the island. And it was believed by some that perhaps the letters inscribed in the tree had been, for all we know, maybe a pointer, you know, some sort of a clue left behind by some of the lost colonists, yeah, that's right, of Roanoke. And that maybe, indeed, these individuals, when they had to leave that colony that had been founded on Roanoke Island, that perhaps they, as they had done there at Roanoke, with the carving of the word Croatoan in a tree, perhaps there were evidences of the settlement moving. It was an interesting legend there on that island. I couldn't tell you if that's exactly what was happening, but you know, National Geographic has reported this week that we may have actually found now the lost colony of Roanoke. The settlers had arrived first in 1587. They disappeared just a short 2.5-3 years later in 1590, leaving behind only two clues. The word Croatoan, as I'd mentioned, which had been carved into a fort's gate post, and then CRO, the words crow that were etched into a tree as well. Now, theories about the disappearance have ranged from an annihilating disease to a violent rampage by local native tribes, and some have even suspected that they may have actually been helped along the way, and that certain members of the lost colony were assimilated into native tribes throughout the Outer Banks and the east coast of the United States. Previous digs have turned up some information and artifacts from the original colonists, but very little seems to be known about what happened to them until now. Now, I've always been fascinated with this mystery, but thanks to technological advances and a cover-up on a map, researchers now think they're getting really close to finding what actually happened to that lost colony of Roanoke Island. The colonists were the third group of English arrivals on North Carolina's Roanoke Island, settling near the modern-day town of Manteo. The first group to arrive in 1584 came to explore and map the land for future groups. A second group came along later in 1585, and they were kind of on a scientific mission. They were gathering data and information about the landscape in the area. But their trip wasn't exactly a friendly one. Unfortunately, tensions during that time as they were exploring the land and gathering scientific data began with the local native tribes, and essentially, of course, this set the stage for what many thought would eventually become the fate of the colonists that would stay there, that third group that, as we mentioned earlier, arrived there in 1587. Now, this third group had entire families, history tells us. There were 17 women, 11 children, and then about 90 men. And that meant the group wanted to settle in the New World, and it was Well, it wasn't a military excursion, according to National Geographic, which would have included only male explorers. They really meant that they wanted to stay, having brought families, women, children, and the like. So, scientists at the British Museum had looked into patches and discovered these tiny little red and blue, this little tiny red and blue symbol. And they'd wondered if there could have been a clue with this little symbol that would, I believe, had been found beneath two patches that had been on a map that the First Colony Foundation in Durham, North Carolina, had put together. They had wanted to know if there could have been something along the lines of a fort or a secret emergency location somewhere on the site. They said, our best idea is the parts of Raleigh's exploration in North America that were a state secret, and the map cover-up was an effort to keep information from the public and from foreign agents. Kind of interesting. It gets almost into the realm of secrecy. But most researchers think that the colonists likely encountered disease, despite the fact that there's this belief that there could be some sort of a fort or a secret emergency location that might have been there somewhere on the site. It's pretty interesting. Now, unfortunately, the clock's caught us right now, but when we come back, we'll dig into this a little bit more deeply because it's been one of those enduring mysteries. We know that they were there. We know they had to go someplace. But what ultimately happened? Did they have an early sort of a panic room that they had there on the location that would become their ill-fated settlement? Or did they go elsewhere? When we come back, we'll continue this mystery and many more. It is the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay with us.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grayling Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Celebrating another week in the weird, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grayling Report, keeping you company every Tuesday evening from 8 p.m. until around 10 p.m. Eastern. But then again, the beauty of doing a podcast is where you get to call your own shots, and, well, you can take a little longer if you need to. Hell, if you wanted to, I suppose you could take shots, but then again, that's not something I'm typically fond of doing while I'm trying to speak articulately upon the radio, right? But nonetheless, welcome back to the program. Glad to be talking with you, as always. Glad to be joined in studio by the Dark Cardinal of Mischief and Mayhem, Tyler.
Yes, it is I.
I think you should be known now forever as, rather than just than Tyler Pittman, I think you should just be Tyler. Just Tyler.
It is Tyler.
Or Mr. Tyler. That would make you sound a bit more...
Sounds like a teacher's name or like a scary poltergeist.
Mr. Tyler came to visit me.
Come here, Mr. Tyler.
We'll call you Mr. Micah.
Yes, I'm the holy grail of, well, the holy grail of Mohorovic investigators of the unexplained, right? I hope everyone remembers the meaning of that terminology, Mohorovic discontinuity. Of course, the home of the Grayling bunker. But I digress. As we were talking, we were looking at the temporary home in the last segment of a group of English colonists who disappeared off the face of planet Earth. For all we know, Hadals grabbed them up and took them down into the hollow Earth. But what's interesting is that utilizing modern technology, we can learn a lot. And I suspect that there are going to be a lot of ancient mysteries that as time wears on, the advent of new technologies will allow us to learn things about these. I mean, imagine if 50 years ago, people who had been out there looking for the lost colonists had something like a proton magnetometer that they could carry with them.
Well, yeah, I'm hoping they're able to solve this lost colony mystery. It seems like they're still
they're close,
closer.
They're close to it. they're close to it. What there is there's new evidence. And what I love is that, you know, again, the question is, have we solved the mystery? Well, in theory, no. It's still merely a theory. But here's the situation. Using a proton magnetometer that measures distortions of the Earth's magnetic field due to the presence, of course, of objects buried underground, but I think it could be useful in finding other things too, structures, old campsites, and the like. They've begun to find what they believe may be the presence of a buried structure and a fence that strongly indicate that there was some sort of colonial presence in this particular area where they've been utilizing this magnetometer. According to researchers at the Museum of Albemarle, while this technology hasn't shed light on the role of Native American populations in the area, they are
pretty important.
Yeah, but they are beginning to get an idea about what may have actually transpired with regard to two Native tribes and how the colonists, of course, may have entered their world and, well, perhaps left it just as well. Roanoke was geographically located in the crux of a socio-political friction between the Sekaton, who held sway over Roanoke, and then the Choanoke, who controlled the nearby waterways around it. Now, they'd been, of course, warring over the land and the water, but here on Roanoke Island, the colonists were caught right in the middle of all this. And so it is presumed that there was probably going to be a lot of hostility between these two organizations, tribes, I should say, and that colonists were going to be trapped in the middle of all that. And since they were trying to explore this area in the midst of this dispute, it wouldn't be surprising, according to a Dr. Swindle of the Albemarle Museum, he said, it wouldn't surprise me that the Sekaton would just want to be done with and get rid of the English. So they're hoping that utilizing modern science, searching for the site of once existent building structures, fences, and the like, and, of course, noting the proximity that these colonists had held to, well, these warring tribes at the time, that they may be a little closer to knowing exactly what happened. But, you know, I'd heard for years legends, Tyler, that among some of the tribes there in the Outer Banks, that there had been natives that would have peculiar traits, things like blue eyes and things like this. And so there had been this longstanding tradition that maybe some of the colonists actually, you know, were assimilated into these groups, and that this would explain the reason for these peculiar traits that emerge among some of the Native Americans decades later. It's a fascinating story. And I've always wondered about that. You know, and it reminds me of something similar that my father had told me about with regard to some of these ancient structures that extend all the way down into parts of Louisiana. But what's interesting is that they are much older structures, nonetheless, that appear to be of Welsh design. Maybe we should get Scott Walter on the program sometime and talk with him about that, because there are a lot of people that look at those sorts of sites as evidence that, well, there were indeed a lot of things going on in the New World, even before it was appropriately called the New World.
Yeah, what are you're talking specifically about this tower or something I read about?
You know, yeah, I don't know all the specifics about that actual location. This was something that my father had told me about. And he had specifically said, you know, this place, it's just fascinating. He's got a friend named Jeff, and Jeff apparently had loaned him some books about this, and so he was really excited about it. And I actually I told my dad, being the he's something of a Fortean scholar in his own right, and so I'd actually told my dad, hey, you know what you should do is you should just come on the Graylian Report and talk about this, be a guest one night. And so, you know, he's very knowledgeable about a lot of things. I think that my father's only done a couple of interviews in the past that dealt with these sorts of subjects, once or twice. But I've often told people that my relationship with Father Hanks is a lot like Indiana Jones, and, well, I guess I'm a lot less like Indiana Jones. I'd like to think, of course, I think all of us would like to think we're like Indiana Jones, but I'm talking about the way that he and his father, portrayed by Sean Connery, interacted with one another.
See, I hated the one with the dad in it.
Really?
I only liked Temple of Doom, honestly.
Really?
I know a lot of people say that's the worst one, but, yeah, Indiana Jones was not, I guess it just wasn't something I was that interested in.
Oh, I loved him. But, you know, then again, though, I'm not like John Ward that I have to go dress like that and go run around in, you know, ancient pyramids. And oh, I'm just picking on him a little bit. Just a little bit. Oh, goodness. No, I mean, you know, I think, though, that, you know, in the spirit of adventure, I think we'd all, in truth, if we had the time and the ability to do it, would like to get out there and search these ancient sites. But yes, my relationship with my own father, I find, is a good bit, you know, like those interactions between Indy Jr. and Dr. Jones Sr. It would be interesting to have my dad. We could have him live in studio. He could tell us all about all this stuff. But then again, I don't know, it also might turn into a geek fest. We'll see what happens. But we'll see how many people email me and say, you know, we'd like to hear Father Hanks on the radio. We'll see. Tyler, you've met him before. I mean, he's an interesting guy.
Yeah, he's a very nice man.
Scholar, brilliant musician. You know, yeah, he's really kind of a jack of all trades, but, you know, brilliant guy. And also a minister. So, anywho, moving right.
I'm sitting here thinking of Newport Tower.
Is that the one, Newport Tower?
Yeah, I think there was, if I recall correctly, it's something like supposedly evidence that someone was here before Columbus of non-indigenous origin.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a lot of reports of those kinds of things. So, you know, maybe it would be interesting to have him in here. Or, you know, Scott Walter would be great to get on the program. I hear he was on the Expanded Perspectives podcast recently just as well. So, but moving right along, this is one of the best stories I've seen all day, and I love this. The secret's out. Barack Obama has done the unthinkable, Tyler. He has finally acknowledged Area 51. It's true.
Now, if only he would recognize Skynet.
Yes.
Something that's applicable to today.
Yes, indeed. It's true. Apparently, here's what happened. Now, at one time, we all know, you know, Area 51 was the most secret place in the entire world. Nobody would talk about it. Earlier this year, the CIA finally acknowledged it. But, of course, it had been also acknowledged, I think, in earlier released documents. It was considered pretty significant that the CIA had finally acknowledged it. And recently, Obama did the exact same thing. He was at the annual Kennedy Center Honors Ceremony, and he decided to basically kind of crack a joke at actress Shirley MacLaine. Now, she, I had mentioned recently, she is friends with a former presidential hopeful named Dennis Kucinich, who claims that he had seen a UFO outside MacLaine's home. And throughout her life, she has claimed to have had a number of encounters with UFOs just as well. But no, seriously, Obama actually made an Area 51 joke. We have audio.
Now, when you first become president, one of the questions that people ask you is, what's really going on at Area 51? When I wanted to know, I called Shirley MacLaine. I think I just became the first president to ever publicly mention Area 51. How's that? So,
isn't that beautiful? Yes, indeed. So we finally have a public mention of Area 51 by a commander-in-chief, and it's while he's telling a joke. But then again, you know, I mean, I'm not someone who's really overtly all that concerned with whether or not there is, you know, a UFO connection with Area 51 right now. I mean, I think as time goes on, we're finding that less and less are there retrieved flying saucers that have been crashed, landed, and then, of course, you know, retrofitted with, you know, U.S.-born parts and whatnot, and then piloted by our own. I think that it seems less likely that this is the kind of technology that's being kept in the hangars up there at Area 51, and we're beginning to see more and more spy planes, drone technologies, and other things. I mean, I would venture to say that, you know, there's a good likelihood that there are some more exotic aircraft than the kinds of things that what we see in the news with regard to drone reports and the like. There are probably those kinds of things too. We've talked about, for instance, the stealth blimps and the like, but, you know, again, there's this mythology that's been built around Area 51 for years, and if you think about it, really, the mystique that the place was able to have, and to this day still has, you know, the level of surveillance, and of course, you know, the armed guards and everything that will show up if you get anywhere near the black mail boxes, so many television programs have sought to do over the years. You know, it's obvious that mystique contributed to the era of secrecy, which, if anything, was conducive to maintaining a level of secrecy about the actual projects that were being carried out there.
Yeah, on second listen to that clip, I think Obama is actually making fun of Shirley MacLaine.
No. Well, of course he is.
But I mean, kind of betraying that a fact that maybe he doesn't, this award is a joke or something. That,
well, yeah.
Given to someone who,
in the clip, you can kind of see when he says that, MacLaine is actually sitting over there. I think she's sitting next to the guitarist Carlos Santana in the actual video. And you can see that when he first makes the statement, Everyone looks at Shirley MacLaine and they're kind of, you know, having a laugh. As a matter of fact, I think there had been an agency that carried the story, NPR, in fact, and they basically described it as Obama using the Kennedy Honors or Kennedy Center Honors Ceremony to crack a joke at the expense of actor Shirley MacLaine. Yeah. So, yeah. So that's what happened. But nonetheless, I thought it was pretty funny because, I mean, if you think about it, at very least in terms of actually the official public statement, I don't think that there has been a president or a commander-in-chief who has publicly spoken about Area 51 before. I don't doubt that there have been...
I think it was more of a mention than him speaking of it.
Well, yeah, but at the very least, he publicly said it. I mean, just as he actually says in the clip, he's the first commander-in-chief to have spoken about it. Granted, yeah, it doesn't amount to anything, but hey, he said it, right? But, you know, there have been a long list of presidents who have been very interested in the UFO enigma. We've talked about this before. And, you know, even before Grant Cameron had actually finalized it, and he did a much better job with it than I did. I mean, I'd written an article for UFO Magazine years ago called All the President's Little Green Men that was looking at a lot of these parallels. I'd talked with Phyllis Galdi at Fate Magazine about during one of the elections, probably not 4 but maybe 8 years ago, and doing a series of articles that you know, as a series of columns that entire election year that would look at presidents and their interest in UFOs. I mean, there were tie-ins that came with the Reagan administration, the Carter administration, the Clinton administration, and some suppose that there are others. And specifically, those involve UFO sightings that took place during the terms as governor of both Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. Now, Clinton, of course, had allegedly told Webb Hubble, who wrote about it in his book, Friends in High Places, I guess was the title of the book. He had claimed that Clinton, when Hubble was hired by Clinton, that Clinton had told him, I want you to find out 2 things for me. I want you to find out who killed Kennedy and what's going on with UFOs. And he allegedly was unable to find out either of those things, despite having, well, Tyler, friends in high places. But, you know, what's also interesting is that if we wanted to bring George Herbert Walker Bush into this, too, famous, of course, for his statements about an NWO, a New World Order. And when we succeed, and we will. You remember? Anyway.
How could I forget?
No one could ever forget that. It's just too good. It's just the kind of thing that just gets enveloped and wrapped inside your brain, and you never forget it. It will stay in your brain forever and ever. It will. And you'll never get rid of it.
It reminds me, I was listening to some news, and I guess Pearson Education that provides a lot of the textbooks and stuff for public schools. I know I use their materials in college. Their new edition of the history text, I guess, for school-age children, I should say high school kids, the chapter from 1985 to 2000 is called A New World Order.
Really? That terminology is used a lot, but that wasn't the only thing, of course, that George Herbert Walker Bush had talked about, because according to Jimmy Carter, it had been during his presidency that he had gone to Bush at the time he'd been the CIA director, and he'd asked him, hey, listen, I would like to know about UFOs. And he was allegedly told by George H.W. Bush, well, sir, you don't have clearance for that information. And so I asked the question years ago, and I would still ask it today. If the president does not hold a need to know with regard to that kind of information or any other kind of information, who does? We'll be back right after this. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report, your weekly one-stop shop for the strange and the unusual, broadcasting from the darkest corner of the World Wide Web. Well, maybe not as dark as some of that stuff, you know, that you hear about in the actual deep web. That's always a disconcerting subject. Maybe we'll just not talk about that. Especially since during the break, Tyler and I were discussing, there was one other president who may have actually been involved with UFOs. Well, there were several. And again, Grant Cameron's already written a lot about this. There's always been that insinuation that Eisenhower had met with ETs and all this sort of stuff. But I'm sorry, I mean, call me a skeptic, but I haven't seen a lot of hard evidence for that. The best evidence, apparently, that was supplied for that alleged argument was that, you know, there'd been a, what was it, he was on a golf retreat or something like that, and Ike had allegedly had to go to the dentist. Somebody had tried to find out if indeed there were dental records that pertained to this and all that stuff, you know. I mean, who knows, maybe he did talk with E.T. Welcome back to the program. When we get into the discussion about presidential UFOs, however, there is certainly one who I think has to be taken into consideration. It's something very interesting. It was first brought to my attention by researcher Jim Mars a few years ago, and someone who I'd love to have seen at Paradigm Symposium one year, but, you know, well, we'll see if there's room in one of the rosters at some point. But, you know, that's an event that fills up quickly, I know. But Jim had pointed out that that apparently there had been a memo that had been put forward, and the memo had something to do with Kennedy making a note to then the, I think it was the NASA director, I think his name was James Webb, if I remember correctly. And this was around the time that there was the proposition for there being, now think about this, this is interesting, in the midst of the Cold War, a joint Soviet-U.S. space program. I always thought that was kind of interesting. Obviously, it was beneficial to both parties. It's still ongoing. You know, I've got a friend or two, in fact, who are still with NASA, and they've been, you know, variously positioned at mission control there in Moscow. I guess it's mission control, what they'd call it. But at the time when they were talking about the institution of that famous joint U.S.-Soviet space program, what Kennedy had apparently told James Webb in a memorandum was that it was imperative that we be able to identify the knowns and the unknowns so as to prevent, well, the inevitable concern that was ongoing throughout the years of the Cold War. And there's been a lot of question about what the knowns and the unknowns might have been that Kennedy was referencing, apparently in reference to spaceflight. But there's a couple of things that should be kept in mind right there. Of course, the insinuation seems to be that Kennedy might have been talking about knowns and unknowns aircraft, obviously, of any known or unknown variety, the unknowns being the ones that are particularly important. But also, there is this aspect that has to be taken into consideration, which entails the fact that as we were becoming a space-faring civilization, when we dealt with seemingly highly advanced exotic aircraft, it is indeed tricky to suppose that with certainty we would know and we would have full expectations for, well, you know, how advanced spacecraft from other worlds might behave. In other words, we were sort of neophytes at this point, at that point in history. We hadn't gone into space. We hadn't traveled into space, at least as far as we knew. With barring the exception, perhaps, of maybe a breakaway civilization or a secret space program, the likes of which Richard Dolan talks about. And we've got to get Rich on the program sometime soon. Get him on. You know, I'd love to. Rich has done so many interviews, and he does so much of this stuff. And we always try to do things on this program that maybe aren't the kind of things that you hear on all the other podcasts. But I really like Rich, and you know, I think we could do something different, and for God's sake, not get into a fight like he and Maloney did last week, huh?
I know, that was heated.
That's funny, because Race Hobbs at KGRA told me it was heated, and I listened back to it, and actually, I didn't think it was all that heated. I could tell that Rich got a little annoyed at one point.
Well, you had already been prepped, so, I mean, listening to it live.
You caught it live, didn't you?
Yeah, it's kind of a, I think I told you that when you listen to it knowing what's going to happen, it's not as much of a fulfillment of this idea of a feud.
I guess if you'd been sitting there listening to the show live and you'd heard, you know, Maloney and Dolan kind of getting into it. And again, I thought they were, you know, Rich was a gentleman as always, and Mac was too, But, you know, he, of course, asked some pretty pointed questions, and I think at one point kind of accused Rich of being a little long-winded. Yeah, but I would love to talk with Rich about, you know, exclusively the idea. What is the best evidence that we have? I could care less about extraterrestrials. And the only reason I say that is I'm not trying to be a denialist. I'm accepting, fully accepting of the possibility that that idea could represent in the broader scope of UFO studies, okay? But, you know, the thing is that there's so much time put into that and so little evidence that seems to substantiate it, whereas I think that when we can't really rule out UFOs at all, and yet there's so little evidence for an extraterrestrial component to it, to my way of thinking, and a lot of people have gotten after me and they really disagree. Funny, I don't get very many emails from our listenership that are in disagreement with me on that point. I think a lot of people are, I think they recognize that I'm not dismissing out of hand the extraterrestrial possibility, but they also recognize that I'm trying to be a bit more, I'm trying to be a little more scrutinizing in the way that I go about studying that evidence. Because so many researchers over the years have just taken it completely for granted. Oh, UFO extraterrestrials, we may be visited. Disclosure. We've got to stand up for the movement. We've got to get the government to disclose what it knows about UFOs. And we've got to accept the otherworldly varieties of intelligence that have been visiting us and all these sorts of things. Hey, maybe it's happening. But, you know, I cannot accept UFOs on the grounds of that is what we're dealing with, as so many have. Because in doing so, we make a presumption about a phenomenon that in truth may not be the reality underlying it, if that makes sense. And I think that's probably why I'm not attacked very often. Certainly there are people who disagree with me and some that have disagreed. I stopped just short of saying violently.
Well, it's just like, I guess ET means something different from alien life. They found, you know, there's some dispute as to whether or not it was planted by space explorers, but bacteria, you know, on satellites, I think Mars, they found some. And it's like, that is alien life, if you believe that it was independently there and not planted by an astronaut.
Hmm. I see, yeah. Extraterrestrial, of course, being, you know, a term for a non-Earth-based life form. But then again, I mean, could you not also have, I guess if it's Earth-bound, if it's something that originates from Earth, even if it's a highly exotic form of life or something that showed up, I mean, alien could still be terrestrial, but alien tends to be a more generic term to use for
sure,
for an unidentifiable intelligence. You know, extraterrestrial, specifically talking about extraterrestrial alien being, EBE, that sort of thing.
Right. Now, see, that's a different term that's not used. I mean, it is within this, you know, study. But I'm convinced myself that there's probably bacteria on Mars.
Or at very least there was at one time. You know, that's
well,
one of
yeah,
the,
that's, you know,
one of the big stories this week, in fact, actually, has been that there's pretty conclusive evidence now. We're almost certain, not because of the actual discovery of water, but because of the discovery of formations that could have only resulted from the flow of water across the Martian surface over time. But yes, Curiosity? I mean, the Curiosity rover has now discovered evidence of, at one time, what had been water on the Martian surface. And if there had been water, you know, I mean,
well, see, this is stuff that I think 2003 this came out, and they're just never satisfied with it. So we send the rover up there, and it's saying once again what I think scientists had found previously. 10 years ago, it would be.
Yeah, well.
And I think at that point it was, you know, vast networks of river, the carvings that were made by the flow of water onto the surface, the Martian surface,
yeah,
seem pretty self-explanatory.
It would seem pretty self-explanatory, and there's been this debate ongoing about that. But, you know, I mean, here we can determine that water once existed on Mars. We haven't conclusively determined that life ever existed there, and yet what a great leap that would be just to be able to determine conclusively once and for all, if ever there had been, even simple life on Mars. You know, and in likelihood, I would think that it probably had been there at some point. It seems that the Martian landscape, it could have been conducive to the presence of water.
Yeah, this was, I guess this is the story one day ago. Mars crater may have supported microbial life forms. The past lake on Mars has the kind of chemicals that could have supported life. See, this is something they were talking about when I was in high school.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something that's been talked about for years. You know, that's the thing is that...
But it's a news story yesterday.
Well, because of the discovery of the presence of conclusive determinations that water was flowing across the surface of Mars. Now, but then again, this is something that has been supposed for a long time. The fact that Curiosity has taken quality images that clearly show, you know, I guess, the effects of erosion.
It's doing analysis, chemical analysis. It's not, they knew there were lakes on Mars, but this, I guess, is saying that the rover has done an analysis and found that the chemicals that are required to support life are indeed in this cavern.
I think the proper term would have been that there was strong evidence that there were lakes on Mars. But I think that we're seeing the best evidence of flowing water in these photographs. You know, on that note, though, I do want to kind of just, and I don't want to sound like I'm being pompous or anything, but in truth, I have to kind of highlight to an extent what a non-story that is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because I'm telling you, I heard about it in high school. But no, they're conclusively saying this was an ancient lake. They're not saying... I think the story here is about the microbes being in it, but it's being taken as, oh, they found that water was once on Mars.
It was an ancient lake that had what in it?
Let me read. An ancient lake that...
You don't have to even read. I can just tell you.
They now say apparently had everything needed to sustain microbes that can live off minerals.
Oh, dude, it had ancient aliens in it.
Well, yeah, there you go.
It had ancient aliens. Although, I have to say, maybe, just maybe, here's what could be going on here. You might be misremembering something, Tyler, huh?
It's possible. It was around the time... I actually found the story from February 12th, 2003.
Okay.
A NASA study shows how water may have flowed on ancient Mars.
It may have flowed. Again, you know, there was strong evidence at that point.
Right. 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now they're talking about conceding that water was indeed on Mars.
Okay. Well, you know, I guess, again...
You're 10 years behind, buddy.
I'm 10 years behind. Well, we don't have to belabor the point. Anyway, Michael Knight... I got this email from a gentleman named Michael Knight, and this was tying into this death hoax thing just a little bit. You know, we talked about Paul Walker and the death, not so much his particular death hoax, but the idea of celebrity death syndrome, as I called it, where you see that someone has apparently passed away and then you find out after the fact, oh wait, that person is still alive. It's really strange. Well, I got a very interesting story from this gent. And here's what he says. He says, I've been listening to a few days late version of the show on Shoutcast. The one about the guy from, I presume he's talking about, the KGRA program, but the one about the guy from Fast and Furious, Paul Walker. He said, I've got a real one. It's analog, he says. So I was driving a U-Haul full of AS400 servers back to San Antonio from our software company as we were moving closer to production. It was me and my wife, and she was actually pregnant at the time, and so it was a bit sketchy because of the heat and the drive. Now, I drive hard, and I don't like stopping unless we have to stop for food or to go to the toilet. So we're standing in line at a fairly teched-out truck stop. It wasn't crappy. It was pretty tech. And so the wife and I, around 11 p.m. their time, are watching the TV above the checkout aisle when we're getting our Pringles or whatever and gas. And then we both witnessed this news story, and it was saying that Mr. Rogers, it's a lovely day in the neighborhood, you know, Mr. Rogers had died. Now, it was kind of crappy despite the fact that I had nightmares about, you know, King Friday and his train crew. King Friday was the little guy, on the set, the little puppet, I guess. nightmares. But we were both thinking that it sucked and noted that it was weird that we heard the news in some truck stop. Well, the folks in line behind and in front of us all kind of gave our 11 p.m. condolences. I mean, who doesn't like, fundamentally, Mr. Rogers? This was deep on I-40, and I totally watched the show big time, and we were all standing there. He said, I had nightmares about King Friday and still watched the show as a kid. I mean to say that there were witnesses. So sometime later, and it must have been a couple of years after the fact, we get the news that Mr. Rogers had actually died, both from television and the internet, like he really died this time. Now tell that to the truckers who were standing there in that same Flying J that I was in. It's a trip, and you're right. Pretty sure that already happened, and I was in a truck stop with truckers, and the dude died. It was right there on television, for real. My wife and I chalk it up to some weird time lapse with no real explanation. Interesting, huh? It's fascinating. I mean, who knows? You hear these stories about alleged time slips from time to time. Could it actually happen? Could people from time to time actually step right out of their typical chronological space-time reality and into an odd set of circumstances where, for whatever reason, everything that they think they know is wrong, and they get information that's bad, or maybe even news that hasn't really happened yet. Is that the explanation for celebrity death syndrome? I don't know. I kind of doubt it. But by the same token, who knows? Mike seems pretty sincere. And his story is certainly an interesting one. We'll wrap things up when we come back. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. As always, stay with us. If you are interested in the unexplained like I am, then you probably want to know everything there is to know about every place there is out there. Anywhere, not just in the United States or in Britain. You want to know all about all the weird stuff anywhere it may be. And one of the less often discussed areas of Fortiana and the unexplained is Australia. And that's why the latest book by Andrew Nicholson, Weird Australia, is a must-have for any paranormal enthusiast's collection. It details and documents reports of yowies, bunyips, and all different kinds of strange happenings that have taken place down under. It's Weird Australia by author Andrew Nicholson, available online as an ebook download on Amazon.com. That's Weird Australia. What are you waiting for? Check it out online right now at WeirdAustralia.com.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
According to the Maya, the rain god Chalk created the vast oceans as he struck the clouds with his axe in ancient times. Some believe today that there may be more to these myths of strange beings, but no modern adventure will explore mysteries of our ancient past like the Ancient Alien Cruise, January 9th through the 13th, 2014. Set sail for a high seas adventure with experts in ancient mysteries and ancient astronaut theories, including author David Hatcher Childress, Dr. Robert Schock, and Hugh Newman. Go where mysteries of the ancients await you, along with a privately led shore excursion to Mayan ruins, and a one-of-a-kind fine dining experience with your guides and speakers aboard one of the specialty restaurants on deck. Sign up early to ensure the speaker of your choice, and reservations made by September 1st will receive $25 per cabin onboard credit. The Ancient Alien Cruise will depart from Fort Lauderdale. Airfare, travel, and insurance is not included, but call for additional pricing and amenities. For details, visit ancientaliencruise.com or call Holiday Maker Travel toll-free at 877-642-4308. Embrace the spirit of adventure. ancientaliencruise.com.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Welcome to your home for weird news, anomalies, exopolitics, and all things that go bump in the night. It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks.
Coming back to you, that's the final segment of this week's edition of the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, glad to have you here. Well, a lot of names in the chat room this week that I don't recognize. A quick shout out to Mara Mayhem and, of course, Paranormal Jared. Good buddy right there. Teague Blue, Wish I Ate the Blue Pill. It could almost read like a novel. No, not Jesus, but Rillum Reeb is in there, huh? Yeah. Good to see some fresh faces in there, as always. you'd like to participate in the live chat during the 8 p.m. Eastern Time live broadcast of the Graylin Report, you can do so by visiting graylinreport.com. Hit the podcast and radio page right there. That's all you have to do if you'd like to be able to participate in the live discussions that we have here on the program. All kinds of ways you can help us out with what we do. You can send along emails to me, info@graylinreport.com, and also tyler@graylinreport.com if you'd like to reach the producer of the program, recommend a potential guest for a future edition of the program. On next week's edition of the Graylin Report, we'll have Soraya Ozkoth joining us on the program. Soraya is going to be coming on, and he's a good buddy of mine. He does Where Did the Rogue Go, the podcast, and whatnot, and I'm really looking forward to having him as a guest on the program, because in addition to being a podcaster, he's got a lot to offer too. And although he does a great job interviewing other people, I often like to interview those who do the interviewing on this program, at least from time to time. It'll be good to get him on here. For those of you who are already going along, I look forward to seeing you on the Ancient Astronaut Cruise, which is going to be taking place, well, the Ancient Aliens Cruise, actually, is what it's called, and it's going to be taking place here in middle January. I'll be one of the guys who's talking about myth, culture, and folklore amidst the ancient alien theories proposed by David Hatcher Childress. Hugh Newman's going to be there, and, of course, my buddy Dr. Robert Schock. Looking forward to that just as well. Tyler, you should tag along, youngin'.
I might. I'll wish upon a star tonight. How about that?
Why don't you get the wife and the little Pittman, and we all need to just go to the beach at some point, because I'm long overdue for a vacation. I mean, in the worst way.
The beach during the winter?
It would be.
It doesn't sound too fun to me.
It wouldn't be worse than the mountains. You know, it might not be better, but, you know, it could be, well, I don't know. Or we could wait until warm weather and go, I'd like to do that. Did you hear about, by the way, the sighting of a giant alien squid that took place apparently over part of England? What they're saying spooked a million people and caused them to believe that there was an actual paranormal occurrence taking place, an alien drifting through the skies. You know, on the Middle Theory podcast, we make frequent reference to Dirgopal, the flying jellyfish, the luminous lady of the skies. Do you know the story of Dirgopal? Do you want to know?
I don't think I do.
You probably don't.
I have seen some images of these things. It sounds kind of Lovecraftian.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's a joke. It's an inside joke is what it is. But, I mean, years and years ago, there was this report of a jellyfish-like unidentified flying object that was hovering over a part of Denmark, and there was a photograph of the thing. And, of course, you know, borrowing from, I believe, the German word for jellyfish, Gopal, this thing was called Der Flying Gopal. And here it was this jellyfish thing hovering up in the sky. What it was believed to be actually was some sort of a plume of smoke that had risen from a factory nearby that was drifting through the air, and it was just a strange formation that, for whatever reason, did kind of have a jellyfish-like look to it. And Nikki in the chat room, she's saying, Dirgopal! She's already asking. Yes, indeed. And the photograph of this thing, I mean, you can't really make out much, but apparently the story was it took place over Bristol. And people had said what looked like a 15-foot-long tentacled beast had appeared. This actually wasn't flying through the sky. This thing had actually been in the water and had been drifting through the water off the coast of the docks, or off the docks along the coast of Bristol. And they said that the footage really freaked people out. Marine biologists were clueless about what this thing was, this strange luminous object. Conspiracy theories had raged on that this mysterious pulsating creature, there's video online, and if you look it up, you can in fact find videos of it. Just look up glowing squid or squid in Bristol. People actually thought it might have been an actual living, glowing creature. So conspiracy theories rage that this mysterious creature could have actually been an alien, the Bristol Harbor alien, they called it. But after apparently notching up a million YouTube hits this past week, nicknamed it Close Encounters of the Bristol Kind, have rumbled now as an elaborate PR stunt for UK TV's entertainment channel Watch. It was a viral stunt. It looks pretty good, though.
I did see this, actually.
Yeah, the photographs of the thing, I mean, look like an actual glowing squid. I wonder how they actually did it. It's pretty interesting. And, I mean, then again, I guess most marine biologists that would see it, you know, wouldn't expect that a squid would actually float or glow like this. But nonetheless, it actually did look like a squid. Pretty funny, huh? But now they're saying that according to the video, which had drummed up millions of hits, Everyone had been fooled. It was indeed just a hoax. Too good to be true. Nothing to see here. Move right along. Next, please, huh? I thought it was interesting, though, because I've always been, ever since I was a child, fascinated with the giant squid.
I don't... So they're saying it was a squid? Because when I saw it personally, it looked interesting, but it looked like it could have been like a robot or something that's meant to clean barnacles off of the hull of ships.
Well...
I didn't see. I really didn't catch the squid part, but I guess it has tentacles or something.
One of the best videos apparently is called.
Oh, that looks so fake now.
Hoax squid in Bristol. Have you found it? Yeah.
That picture has definitely come out since the initial video was on sites. What, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah. Well, you know, years and years ago, and I've told this story before. Maybe I had participated in a UFO hoaxing event, right? And this reminds me of Dergopel. Nikki's wanting to know, where's her call? Have you ever heard the call of Dergopel, Tyler?
Yes.
You have?
Sounds like a turkey.
It does sound kind of like a turkey. That particular luminous lady frequents the Middle Theory podcast. I don't know if she'll be able to come out and make an appearance on Graylian. We'll just have to see. But anyhow, yeah, if you'd like to get more up to speed on this Gopel mythology, you can tune into Middle Theory. But years ago... my co-host on that program, Tyler McNonymous, and I, we decided we wanted to make a flying Gopel. We wanted to make a giant flying jellyfish, and we attempted. There are photographs somewhere of this online, and what we did was we took this great big piece of, like, see-through tarp, and we filled it with multicolored balloons and all different kinds of weird lightweight, you know, gauze and things like that to kind of make it, give it a swirling kind of effervescent, or that's not the term, but, you know, it had kind of a... you know, almost kind of a glowing appearance to it. And I think we actually put little LEDs and things in there just as well. I think we put a little glow-in-the-dark paint, and then we had these tethers that would kind of hang down, these ribbon-like arms of the jellyfish. Just think like a Portuguese man of war. And so it was illuminated and then tethered to a long cable and then carried aloft by helium balloons. And the thing, you know, at night it looked pretty good. It was glowing from a distance. You wouldn't have known what it was, you know. You would have thought it was a great big jellyfish floating around, maybe. You know, in the daylight hours, unfortunately, it looked like a great big bag of balloons drifting overhead. But it would be interesting to see. And there have been supposedly a lot of reports over the years of jellyfish-like things. And I've traced this back. The earliest I have found, as far as a reference to jellyfish-like UFOs, I don't know that these would really qualify as being UFOs, but the earliest reference that I've found was mention made in a story that was written by Arthur Conan Doyle called The Horror of the Heights. And again, this is back when aviation was in its infancy. And so this pilot flies into the upper atmosphere, I mean, higher than he thought he could safely go, but he wanted to see what was really, really, really high up in the sky. And he keeps flying higher and higher. And he gets to this altitude where there are these beautiful, luminous jellyfish flying around up in the upper atmosphere. I mean, real Dergopels.
Yeah, it's just like mirroring what is in the ocean, what's below is above or whatever.
Well, again, in the early years of the UFO, iridescent, there we go. There's a good word coming from the chat room there. That would be what we would apply, yes. The Dergopel is an iridescent-looking flying jellyfish. But Gopel-like beings certainly appeared in this story by Arthur Conan Doyle. I think the entire thing's probably, it's in the public domain now, so you could find the entire thing online. But Gopel... I guess coming back to his story first, he gets up there and he's flying along and everything and he sees these jellyfish. And yeah, it's funny because I guess in this fiction rendition of what the upper atmosphere might be like, Doyle, and it was purely fiction, but he nonetheless postulated that there could be these, you know, ocean-like beasts in the upper atmosphere, but that these things, of course, also would come after him and, you know, try and eat him. And maybe this, I've wondered... if this truly could have been the inspiration for later hypotheses that Ivan Sanderson, Trevor James Constable, and a few others put forth regarding alleged UFO sightings. There were people who actually claimed that they thought that the UFOs might be atmospheric life forms. You don't hear that very much now because of our knowledge of course, space, sky astronomy, and whatnot being far greater than what it once was. But it's very interesting. It's very interesting to think about the fact that, again, and I think that this has happened a number of times, that technology, rather, science fiction, I should say, influences the actual thought that is applied to things like the study of unidentified flying objects. And so what I end up finding time after time again is that whether it be newspapermen calling UFOs flying saucers or whether it be people speculating based on fiction that had been written decades previously about the possible identity of the phenomenon underlying whatever people think UFOs may or may not be, you look at this phenomenon and you start seeing that the people who are researching it are actually probably applying a lot more, you know, I don't want to say it's all entirely fanciful, but there is a lot of speculation that is applied and that is influenced by pop culture. And people would, you know,
I can remember Star Trek episodes with the flying jellyfish.
Yeah. So it's funny. But again, yeah, so as far as there being a literal cult of a flying jellyfish, I don't know if there's such a thing, but we like to pretend, at very least around these parts, that very well may be the case. Just as much influenced, perhaps, by Arthur Conan Doyle and his contributions to early fiction and later speculation in regard to the UFO phenomenon. It's kind of funny how that all comes together, isn't it? Hey, we're only weeks away from Christmas, my friends, and that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the program. But in the coming weeks, as we mentioned, we'll have our buddy Soraya here on with us, and then, of course, a few other wonderful surprises yet to come. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and all those other fantastic seasons. Greetings to all of you out there. And on behalf of all of us here at the Graylian International Studios, we bid you adieu, my friends. Until next time, as always, stay strange and stay warm. I hear that in East Antarctica, Tyler, the temperature's got all the way down to 135 degrees, negative 135.8 degrees Fahrenheit.
I saw that. I'm glad that the blob is safely trapped under ice.
Yes, indeed. He'll stay there as long as it's cold in Antarctica. Stay warm out there and stay strange. We'll talk to you again next week.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.